Monitor now invites you to Meet the Press, America's press conference of the air, a public affairs presentation of NBC News. Today's guest will be McGeorge Bundy, special assistant to the president, who returned this week from Vietnam. We'll bring you today's program in a moment.
This is Ed McMahon, your Saturday afternoon monitor host. There's a new word in the electronics industry today, and that word is microelectronics. What is microelectronics? Sunday night, Monitor has the answer, and host Frank Blair gets the facts.
If any single word describes profound changes in man's life in this 20th century, that word is electronics. And now along comes something called microelectronics, destined to create even greater changes in our lives. With me now is Dr. John Sprague, Senior Vice President in charge of research and development for the Sprague Electric Company. Dr. Sprague, what is microelectronics?
Microelectronics, in its simplest definition, is the placing on a single substrate of more than one element that you might find in a radio, such as capacitors, resistors, and transistors.
This is the type of high-level interview you'd expect to hear on Sunday Night Monitor. Informative, provocative, and stimulating.
Freedom. The more you use it, the longer it lasts. This is the theme of this year's Freedom's Roll Call. Colonel John Glenn, chairman of the roll call, believes it should be drummed into the mind of every citizen. We agree with him, for unless we keep freedom strong by exercising the rights and privileges of the American way, we will surely lose them. Learn what you can do. Send for a free copy of Freedom's Handbook. Write Freedom's Foundation, Valley Forge, Pennsylvania. And now, Meet the Press. Today's guest is McGeorge Bundy, special assistant to the president. Our panel consists of Max Frankel of the New York Times, Clayton Fritchie of Newsday, Peter Lissagor, Chicago Daily News, and Ray Shearer, NBC News. Our moderator is Neil Boggs, NBC News.
Now we'll have the first questions from Ray Shearer of NBC News.
Mr. Bundy, you have just returned from Saigon after being there a year ago. What did you find? Is the situation worse, better, or about the same?
Well, the situation has changed in the last year and changed in a number of respects. But on the whole, Mr. Shearer, my own strong feeling is that there is more reason to be hopeful about the eventual result there now than there was a year ago. Early in 1965, when I was last out there, the situation faced by the people in government of South Vietnam was a very grave one. It was widely felt on both sides, I think, that it was only a matter of time before the communists would win unless something serious was done about it. Well, things have been done in the last year. I think the government there is stronger. The basic position of the non-communist forces, greatly reinforced, of course, by our own strength, has improved, and I was encouraged by what I saw this time.
A prominent member of the administration said today that we have turned the corner in Vietnam. Would that be your view after being there?
Well, I don't think I want to be very precise about how long it may take, but I would say yes, that what was a downward course in a year ago is, though it will be, I think, hard and difficult and has many real challenges still in it, is an upward course now.
What is your personal assessment of General Key?
Well, I have never found it useful for staff assistants to engage in personal assessments of any statesman here or abroad, but I would say that the Thieu Ky government, Key is the prime minister and the chief of state is General Thieu, is the most promising government that we have had since the time in 62 or early 63 when the Diem government got into such great difficulties with its own opinion.
We are asking General Key to lead what amounts to a social revolution. Isn't this expecting rather much from a man who has spent his whole career as a fighter pilot?
Well, we aren't asking him to do it, Mr. Shearer, or at least not alone. He is himself asserting very energetically the purpose of his government of moving in that direction. It's certainly true, and he is the first to say it, that he is a relatively young man and that he has there are kinds of experience that he has not yet had, but I think the impression of those observing the government out there, as I said a minute ago, is that it is honestly and seriously committed to this purpose, and that it is the most promising that we've had for several years.
Mr. Bundy, we have 200,000 men there now, enough to hold on to what we have, but apparently not enough to take over the countryside and make the pacification program really work. Isn't it true that we'll need many more Americans, perhaps 500,000 in Vietnam, to really pacify the country and control the rural population?
Well, that's a very large question, and I certainly don't wish to suggest that I know or that any of us can say now exactly what level of U.S. forces may be appropriate from time to time. I think it's dangerous and misleading to put too much weight on the large figures that are sometimes put forward more by individuals, I think, in Congress and in the public, certainly, than by the administration. Moreover, I think it's important, very important, for us all to understand that the problem of pacification, of security and peace and progress in the countryside, is by no means exclusively a problem of the level of organized armed force, still less of the specific level that American forces may reach. One of the great objects of the Honolulu meeting and of the Vice President's follow-up trip in Saigon was to make clear the concern of both governments, South Vietnamese government and our own, for these less military aspects of the problem, which may in the end have as much to do with the real pacification of the countryside as anything that happens on the battlefield.
We'll continue the questioning now with Mr. Lissagor.
Mr. Bundy, Senator Robert F. Kennedy of New York, a former cabinet officer who'd worked closely with you in the executive branch, has proposed rather more directly than anyone else, I think, up to this point, that the communist Viet Cong be permitted, and I'd like to use his words, be admitted to what he calls a share of power and responsibility, and saying that this is, quote, the heart of the hope for a negotiated settlement in Vietnam. Do you believe it to be the heart of the hope of a settlement in Vietnam to include these communist elements?
Well, Mr. Lissagor, Senator Kennedy is, I'm proud to say, a close friend of mine. We have worked closely together, and I don't want to comment directly on his views. I think I can say that the administration does not take the view that admitting the communists to a share of power and responsibility would be a useful or helpful step, one that would really lead to peace. I think our view is rather that what is needed is a sufficient degree of peace in that country and of absence of subversion and terror so that there can be a reasonable expression of the political feeling of the people of South Vietnam. We are in favor of that. We are prepared to abide by the result of any such free expression of feeling. We are confident from all that we have seen in these last years that the people of South Vietnam want no part of communist dictatorship. Speaking for myself, I would have to add, Mr. Lissagor, that I don't believe there's much promise in the Popular Front idea. I'd hold with the view that President Kennedy expressed in Berlin back in June of 1963. This subject was on his mind, and what he said was, I am not impressed by the opportunities open to Popular Fronts throughout the world. I do not believe that any Democrat can successfully ride that tiger. I think it's very important to distinguish between that kind of Popular Front idea, which is not historically a promising one, and the very real and important need which we do have to live at peace with great communist powers, being ourselves a great power with an obligation for the peace of the world.
Yet, Mr. Bundy, didn't President Kennedy accept a coalition government in Laos, in the neighboring country? And has that not held up rather beyond our expectations as a viable government?
The principal point in the Laos negotiations was the role in that country of Prince Souvanaphouma, who was the leader of the middle faction. President Kennedy very wisely gave the support of the United States to the notion that Prince Souvanaphouma was and should be an important element, and now is, of course, the chief of the government of Laos. I don't think we can say that that government has proven that communists and non-communists can, in fact, cooperate in the government of the country. It has, in fact, not worked out that way. But it has brought to our side, or rather to us to the side of, an important, very important element in the government of and society of Laos, namely the force for which Prince Souvanaphouma stands. If you turn the question around, therefore, forgive me for my long speech, and say that there should be room in the political society of South Vietnam for all forms of people who are willing to live at peace with their neighbors, and that there is no problem about there being men of different political opinions, then I think you have a very different problem. It's when you talk about the usefulness of putting communists in a position of power and responsibility that I think you're in trouble.
Mr. Bundy, we've heard it said that the only really organized political party, if you can use that expression, in South Vietnam is the communist-dominated National Liberation Front in the South. Why is it impossible not to have or develop a workable party or workable parties in Saigon today? Why can't the government establish, create, develop a party which would at least offer a counter to the National Liberation Front?
Well, there are political tendencies and political forces and political groups, and the government itself is, as I believe, rather more representative than your question gives it credit for. It seems to me that there should be, and this is, I believe, the position of the Khi government, continuing efforts to develop political forces and to give them an opportunity to express themselves, both in the framing of a new constitutional framework and in free elections. One of the things that seems to me ironic in the discussion we've had in this country is the notion that it is our side that is against free elections. That's just not so.
Mr. Fritchie.
Well, first of all, I think I speak for my colleagues in saying that we're all going to miss you here, and that your brains and ability are going to be missed in the government. Now, I'd like to follow up for a second on a question Mr. Lissagor made about Laos. I don't think any of us regard the situation as ideal, but I believe you served under President Kennedy that he chose that compromise rather than armed intervention. Would you not say the situation in Laos is at least better than it is in Vietnam?
The situation in Laos is that there is an undeclared contest of force going on right now, Mr. Fritchie. It is true that our position with respect to that contest is better, in my judgment, than it would have been if we had not made very clear our willingness to go the limit for a peaceful settlement. The same thing has been done, in my judgment, by President Johnson in his Baltimore speech and ever since, with respect to our desire to have a peaceful and decent settlement in Vietnam, too. And I don't think there's any question we have shown ourselves repeatedly to be in favor of this kind of peaceful, decent, democratic development. That, I'm sure, was the underlying reason for the inability of our government to give full support to the Diem regime against its critics when that regime became repressive and lost the confidence of the people of South Vietnam.
Let me turn to Vice President Humphrey, who, according to the papers today, made a statement yesterday in Australia saying the United States is going to halt Chinese efforts to extend its control throughout, I believe the exact quote is, across the underbelly of Asia. Now, does that mean the United States is going to intervene in Laos, Cambodia, Thailand, Burma, India?
I think the United States has no intention in any area of acting against the interests and concerns of the people and government concerned. And our presence in any given country is always, should be, and I believe has been, responsive to the needs and requirements of the people of the area. We are not setting ourselves up, as the Secretary of State said the other day, as a policeman for the world. We are concerned by the evident ambitions and aggressive purposes of the regime in Peking, and we are concerned to give appropriate support to those who are threatened by that force.
Isn't it a fact, Mr. Bundy, if I may pursue this just a second, that in the last 10 years or so, Communist China has not taken over any country either by military conquest or by subversion? My own recollection is that during that period of a decade or so, it has lost out in Indonesia, Malaysia, India, Ceylon, Cuba, most of Africa. Why is it we have to go to such great lengths to contain a power that seems to be receding rather than expanding?
Well, Mr. Fritchie, I don't think there's much doubt that the Chinese communists used force, and fairly energetic force, against Tibet.
That's 50 years ago.
They have on two occasions against India, that they participated very energetically in the Korean War, and that they are related to the efforts made by Hanoi in South Vietnam.
Well, I quite agree
that many of the efforts they have mounted have been frustrated, and that these efforts are frustrated primarily by the energies and actions of the people against whom they mount these attacks. I don't dispute that. I think that's exactly right. But I think it's also true that the resolution and strength of the United States has had a great deal to do with some of these happy results.
Mr. Frankel?
Ms. Bundy, if I understood you correctly, you're saying to Senator Kennedy and some of the other critics that, in effect, a coalition arranged with our help at any negotiation with communists could not really work. It's a popular front, and they are likely to be entirely in the saddle within a matter of days, weeks, or months. Is that essentially...
No, I don't want to. I really don't want to speculate about how such an enterprise would work. I do not think, myself, that I'll stand with the position, which, as I say, I always understood to be President Kennedy's position, that popular fronts are not promising, and a popular front, by definition, is a government into which you give some power and responsibility to the communists.
Right.
I might add, Mr. Frankel, and I think this is an important point, that there's nothing whatever in the public or private statements of the communists in Vietnam which would suggest that they would be interested in a share. What they talk about is control.
Right. Your critics then say that if that is not be the case, then really there is not much alternative to a rather prolonged trial of strength to see who becomes at least the organizer of the free elections. I mean, on paper, they're for free elections, and we have said that we want free elections. It seems to me the quarrel then is who is going to be in command for the period in which they are organized in some way. What then is there to negotiate, if not this kind of compromise coalition government that would in turn organize the elections?
Well, it seems to me there is a great deal to negotiate. Once you get an understanding of the basic fundamental proposition that neither the people and government of South Vietnam nor we are going to accept or permit a communist takeover by force. The ways and means of an election can certainly be discussed. The ways and means by which there would be adequate guarantees, which Senator Kennedy speaks of, open for discussion. The ways and means by which you would move from this rather complex and variegated battlefield to a situation of peace. All these can be discussed. What one has to have, however, Mr. Frankel, is a discussion. And that's what we've been unsuccessful in getting from the other side so far.
The administration, in talking about this idea of negotiations, is rather put out, and I think understandably so, that the other side is saying that the communists must be recognized as the sole representative of the South Vietnamese people. Are we, in effect, saying, however, in reply to that, that until we have elections, the Saigon government is now constituted, or its successor, must be the sole representative of the South Vietnamese?
The Saigon government is and has been recognized over the years by us and by many others as the government of South Vietnam. I think that is our position, Mr.
Then, in effect, we are saying that it is that government which we are supporting, which we want to be in the saddle in the period in which the free elections would be organized.
I think our position, Mr. Frankel, is that... that government is the government of South Vietnam. It is being challenged. We haven't any doubt that as between that government and the communists, there is a clear preference of the people of South Vietnam not to fall under communist control. We are very concerned to find ways and means, with the cooperation of the people and the government of South Vietnam, for a genuinely free choice, one which would be recognized and accepted as a free choice. And I must say, I think our record over the last 25 years with respect to free elections entitles our assertions to some faith and credit on this point.
Mr. Scheer, Bundy, I wonder if we might ask you why you are leaving government at this critical time.
Well, I've been on this particular job for over 5 years, and I myself believe that it's time for any... one who moves in and out of government, as I've done more than once before, that comes a time when it is in everybody's interest that someone else have a whack. I was quite clear that a time would come sometime in this, approximately this period, when it would be right for me to move on. And it happened that at the end of the year, people at the Ford Foundation asked me if I would consider that job. And for many reasons, my longtime interest in education, my experience in that field, and my work down here, I felt that that was a challenge I ought to have a try at.
You have written about what the Kennedy administration contributed to foreign policy. What would you say about the Johnson administration as of this moment of your departure?
Well, I think the thing I'd better say about the Johnson administration today is that I'm working in it, and I'm working for the president, and I must say I'm proud to have had the chance to work with him, as with President Kennedy. I don't think that in their fundamental purposes and directions, the two administrations are different. I think they are alike. Their continuity is visible in policy and in personnel, too. So I would simply say that most of the things I've said about the Kennedy administration, I would be glad to repeat for the Johnson administration.
In your article about the Cuban Missile Crisis, I think you made some rather large point about the virtues of restraint, of not pushing the other side to the wall. I wonder what the analogy is for the Vietnam situation.
I think this is important. And I might say that I have watched President Johnson for more than 2 years now, and if I had to pick one noun more than another to describe his policy in Vietnam, it would be restraint. I think we sometimes forget, especially in the way the debate has been shaped in recent days in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, that there is a substantial group of people in this country, perhaps 10%, who would like to go a lot further than the president has gone. If I had to bet, I would bet that in popular sentiment as a whole, and using these crude slogans, there are more hawks than doves with respect to the current policy of the administration. The president has done those things which seem to him necessary from the point of view of the interests and commitments of the United States, and not more. And I think when people talk, as they do somewhat loosely, about escalation, as if somehow there were going to be enormous masses of people thrown around for no reason, they should ask themselves the more realistic question. If you are the president, commander-in-chief, and you have had 200,000 men doing a magnificent job, in my judgment, on a very rapid deployment and a prompt engagement and on sympathetic understanding of the needs of the people and the soldiers of South Vietnam, you have those men there, you have an absolutely first-rate commander. Let us suppose that he does say to you, and I wouldn't be surprised if General Westmoreland would say at some time in the next weeks, I need another 20,000 Marines. The president will look that over, and he'll make a thoughtful judgment. But it doesn't seem to me that there's too much doubt after he's carefully reviewed it as to what that judgment would be.
Gentlemen, we now have less than 2 minutes left. Mr. Lissagor.
Mr. Bundy, in line with your answer just now, one of the things that troubled the senators on the Foreign Relations Committee and a great many other people is this phrase, our commitment in Vietnam is open-ended. The Mansfield-Aiken report used it. Secretary Rusk and General Taylor did not really refute that fact. And I'd like to ask you simply whether, in a situation where the enemy really controls the scope and intensity of a war, whether you could have any other policy but an open-ended one.
Well, I think the phrase is not a particularly accurate one or descriptive one, because it seems to me it suggests that the other man can easily open the floodgates and put any amount of force anytime he wants into South Vietnam. Now, that's not true, Mr. Lissagor. It's a hard and difficult business to move forces from north to south, and the basic justification in military terms of our air action against that infiltration is that it keeps a ceiling on what they can move in. People who talk about overextension of the United States, or who believe that somehow we are in a place where whatever our interests and whatever our moral justification, both of which I think are strong, somehow it's too far away and we can't get there, are simply not aware of the real facts of sea and air power. We have developed 5 points at which we can put forces in there. It's easier for us to get to South Vietnam,
for
the Red Chinese.
I'm sorry to interrupt, sir, but our time is up. Thank you, Mr. Bundy, for being with us today on Meet the Press.
Thank you, Mr. Boggs. In a moment, we'll tell you how you can get a copy of this week's Meet the Press interview.
The Federal Bar Association reminds us that freedom depends on the rule of law. The law protects you, so respect it, uphold it, and obey it. And here to help promote respect for the law and for those who enforce it is Mr. Ross D. Davis, Executive Administrator, United States Small Business Administration.
Many of us, when we hear of the need to increase respect for law, think only of the criminal law. Yet, if we were to look at the shelves of a law library, we would find that the volumes dealing with the criminal code take up relatively little space compared to that occupied by the civil statutes. I believe that the head of a civil agency, such as ours, should emphasize the importance of respect for our civil laws. We in government service must administer our civil laws with fairness, impartiality, and without arbitrariness. And those of us who must deal with the government must do so with confidence that all these civil laws will be administered without fear or favor and without discriminatory or preferential treatment. Disdain for civil laws can only lead to a deterioration of respect for all laws, criminal as well as civil.
You've just heard, pre-recorded, Mr. Ross D. Davis, Executive Administrator, United States Small Business Administration, speaking in behalf of the Federal Bar Association in support of its Law Observance Program. Here now is a message from the U.S. Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. During this announcement, you will breathe about 20 times, and the chances are that the air you're breathing is not as clean as it should be. Since most of us have problems enough without worrying about where our next breath of clean air is coming from, it's very good to know that our local air pollution control officer is on the job. It's a big job, and he needs all the help he can get. The Federal Clean Air Act will help your local air pollution control authority, but he needs your help, too. And one way to give a hand is by participating in the activities of local civic and service organizations which are fighting air pollution. For more information on what you can do to help your local control authorities, write to your local or state air pollution agency or to Clean Air Public Health Service, Washington, D.C. For a printed copy of today's Meet the Press interview, send 10 cents in coin in a stamped, self-addressed envelope to Merkle Press, M-E-R-K-L-E, Merkle Press, Box 2111, Washington, D.C. Meet the Press will be heard again next week at the same time when our guest will be Secretary of Labor, W. Willard Wirtz.
Hi, this is Bill Cullen. Chet Huntley, Arlene Francis, Frank Blair, and I are heard each weekday on Emphasis on NBC Radio.